Lester Young opening up this afternoon's Fresh Air. There is a school of psychiatrists who believe that many mental disorders, ranging from some forms of depression to schizophrenia, are biological in origin. They believe that talk therapies that help a client understand their behavior by uncovering motivations in the past and present are ineffective in treating disorders that are biologically based. This new school is referred to as biopsychiatry, and biopsychiatrists treat their clients with the drugs like antidepressants and antipsychotics that have recently been developed. We'll discuss biopsychiatry at 4 o'clock today with Dr. Donald Klein, who's the co-author of a new book called Mind, Mood, and Medicine. He's also a professor of psychiatry at Columbia and the director of the psychiatric research unit of the New York State Psychiatric Institute. I'll also speak with Dr. Tom Casey. He's a pediatrician and children's neurologist at St. Christopher's Hospital. He works with children who have developmental disabilities like mental retardation, learning disabilities, and neuromuscular disorders. We'll discuss his approach to the use of psychiatric drugs in conjunction with other therapies. Every Tuesday at 3:30, we feature Jazz Revisited with Hazen Schumacher. The subject today is trio recordings from Zutty Singleton to Lenny Tristano. E.L. Doctorow's novels combine history and fiction. His recent novels include The Book of Daniel, Ragtime, and Loon Lake. The film Ragtime, directed by Milos Forman, is scheduled to open in Los Angeles in mid-November. Doctorow is in Philadelphia today to lecture in the Temple University Center City Writers Program. He'll be with us in about 40 minutes or so, maybe 35 on Fresh Air. The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts Show and Contemporary Realism has helped to focus the attention of viewers and critics on different approaches to modern representational art. One of the painters featured in the show is Sidney Goodman, who is my guest. Sidney Goodman grew up in South Philadelphia. His father was a furrier. His mother acted in the Yiddish theater. He went to school at the Philadelphia College of Art, and he later taught there for about 18 years. He now teaches at the Academy. He's had one-man shows at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts Peel House, George Washington University, the Philadelphia Museum College of Art, the Schenectady Museum. His work has been in group exhibitions at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Whitney, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and the Corcoran Gallery. A show of his work will open at the Institute of Contemporary Art, a part of the Virginia Museum, in December. I'd like to just read you a short excerpt from an essay about Sidney Goodman that was written by George Bunker, who's the chairman of the art department at the University of Houston. At first reading, he seems to be making matter-of-fact statements about everyday events. His people are prototypes of our neighbors or ourselves. His settings are landscapes of the ordinary. Only the light is a shade too high key. The contrasts are too stark, as if a flashbulb at high noon, or doomsday, had taken us unaware, caught up short in the moment of our indifference. At other times, and often in his loose, dark-washed drawings or his softly smudged charcoals, he's more random. He records our inattentive moments, daily acts, bathing, resting, getting dressed, half-states of bemusement, our hands busy with the chores of habit, our minds elsewhere. Always there are intimations of other meanings. An early painting shows a resting gymnast strapped by indigo bands of shadow to the geometry of a floor. Another presses the opulent earth of an open hillside against the flatted tones of a city skyline. A third gives parallel stereo-opticon images of a child standing in a bathtub, one warm and direct, the child she is now, the other one private, withholding, hearing her own voice, already a woman. Still another interrupts five people in a room. They regard us matter-of-factly, yet they are utterly closed off, unyielding, neither receptive nor hostile, simply there, waiting to be alone again for the unfolding of their private story. All of the pictures share two things in common, the commonplace and a kind of mute foreboding. They are both casual and final, the everyday and its obverse self. The events that seem to be happening or on the point of it are neither real nor surreal in ordinary terms. Neither gravity is suspended nor logic. Rather, we are persuaded to acknowledge another reality altogether. Its events are not to be understood by analysis, but by acceptance. And we do just that. We perceive again, however darkly, the duality of our own existence. In the end, Goodman's paintings invite our attention because we recognize their paradox and our own. Again, that's an excerpt of an essay by George Bunker, the chairman of the art department at the University of Houston. Sidney Goodman, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
The realism show at the Academy has brought to our attention the work of a number of painters who've abandoned abstractionism to become realists. Mm-hmm. Have you always painted as a realist?
When I was in art school, what was being taught at the time was a kind of academic, non-objective painting. I mean, usually when there's a movement afoot, it usually filters down to the art schools, and at that time, that's what was being taught, so I was doing that. But I was also drawing from the figure.
Uh-huh. How did you find your subject matter?
I guess it was just there. I often use what's around me. It could be anything from something seen in a backyard, a city street, friends, models. Sometimes if I'm in the studio setting up a model for a class, I may use that particular setup or situation for something in my own work. So that's often how things... I don't often know when a subject for a painting will come about.
When you started to paint, did like the stuff around you seem somehow inappropriate for paintings?
Right.
I don't think people were painting... You grew up in South Philadelphia,
yeah.
And I don't think that was at the time a very popular subject for painting.
No, but the curious thing is that a lot of childhood memories and images go back to some of the things that I can remember as a child living in South Philadelphia. For instance, a column of smoke appearing at the end of what was 7th Street. I always remember that image, and it had a particular smell to it. Of course, I never did anything like that specifically, but if I think about past times, I'll remember that, and there are other things. I was just talking to someone today who was asking me a question in connection with this essay that will be written for this show that you mentioned.
In Virginia.
About childhood images. And I think many of the things that artists use, whether it's writing or painting, music, whatever, often things that happen in childhood evoke and stay with one into adult life, and whether it's preconceived or whether it's in the self subconscious, often they may recur, although not specifically, but they sort of inform the work in an indirect way.
Did you have any paintings that used to terrify you when you were young?
No, in fact, I remember that didn't terrify me, but in my father's store, he had a painting, I remember, of a woman. You know, it was a typical like Dutch genre scene of a woman carrying two buckets of water, you know, strapped on her shoulders. And she was looking at a house where obviously she was making some, like a sale, but you couldn't really see her face, and you couldn't see the face of the people inside the house. You know, it was a typical storytelling type painting, but I always remember that. And there was a famous Remington painting. My mother had bookends of... I think it was called The Last Roundup, and there was a cowboy on a horse, and you couldn't see the face, and it was sort of pointed in a very mournful position. So little things like that I can recall, but I don't think that influenced me. Although maybe it sounds like it did after.
I don't know. I think that everybody seems to have these paintings in their past that used to scare them. My grandmother's apartment had one on the first floor. I think it was a biblical painting.
Uh-huh.
It used to scare me all the time. You used to paint violent scenes... a while ago. I don't really think I've seen those paintings.
The early work was very was influenced by German expressionist paintings.
How violent were they? Would you describe a couple of the canvases?
Well, I think a lot of them they drew on the Holocaust imagery. Even things that I was doing in school as a student. I mean, the style was far removed from the way I'm painting today, but just in terms of subject matter, I think but you see, that was in the 50s, and there was a lot of, Camus was important at the time, a lot of existential writing, and just from my own, personal view of things, I remember seeing the pictures of the death camps at from Life magazine when I was must have been about 8 years old, and I think I'm not the only. There have been many people that have come up with the same kind of reaction. Again, a child looking at something that was very difficult to comprehend.
But you...
So the work at that time grew out of things like that. And then other things, street scenes. I grew up in a neighborhood where sometimes there would be random violence, and often I would just... be part of my consciousness. I've gotten away from that, but at the moment I seem to be going back occasionally to a theme like that, but with different, but with all the things I've picked up on the way, so the painting is very different formally than the way it was at that time.
There's actually a lot of historical precedence for violence in painting, isn't there? I mean, between battle scenes and somebody's liver
the crucifixion,
being plucked out.
Sure. I mean, themes illustrated from the Bible have often dealt with that, with sex and violence. It's the old thing.
Ever popular yeah. subjects. So why did you eventually give up that kind of imagery in your paintings?
Well, things happen in one's life. You settle down. Family genre scenes start to become important. I did a series of things on children in backyards, which at first I never thought I would be doing. But the longer you look at something, it accumulates in the mind, and after a while it builds up to the point where it takes on greater meaning than it had at first. For instance, a swing set in the backyard with kids playing. I never would have thought I'd be doing anything with a swing set, and yet that swing set appeared in the, when was it, the late 60s, early 70s in many drawings and paintings. Red, white, and blue swing set. And
you wouldn't have thought of it because...
It was a very banal, stupid-looking thing. I mean, it was functional. Kids had fun on it, but in terms of it being a subject for a painting, on first contact, it didn't seem to be very interesting.
What made it appealing?
Well, as I said, I think the longer one looks at something, it gradually becomes more important. It starts to seep into the consciousness, and it just gathers momentum, in a sense. And so what seemed at first not very interesting suddenly has possibilities for other implications.
Do you usually paint from photographs or set up in front of the landscape or person that you're painting?
Well, the way I work is I combine different things. Many of the paintings, I use memory, direct observation, Polaroids that I take. So it's kind of conjured. Like I might have an idea for a painting and I have to find ways to fit it together. So I'll use whatever means that I have at hand, whether it's direct or indirect, and use that in some way till it comes together. So it's not any one way. I might have someone take a picture of me. So in a sense, I'm kind of like a director orchestrating, staging something that is embedded in the imagination.
You know, all the scams that have been developed around the theme of, hi, I'm a painter, or hi, I'm a photographer, and I'd like to do you nude sometime. How about meeting me at my studio at 12:30 tomorrow? How do you get someone to pose nude for you? Do you have to know them well first?
Yeah, they might. It would be professional models, friends.
I should think professional models might be uninteresting in a way because you don't. I would imagine that you wouldn't want, outside of an exercise, that you might not want a body that's that accustomed to being scrutinized
well,
and painted.
Well, not necessarily. Like if I chose a model to sit or do something. For a painting to pose in, it would be because there was something about that particular model that I wanted, that I felt had a possibility for being used in the painting. So, like, I would have an idea about it first. So I could do something with it. But if nothing, if there was no connection made, I just would drop it.
I think the notion people have is that anyone who models nude must have this really, like, perfect... gorgeous body, but as a painter, are you interested in perfect bodies?
No, not at all.
What makes for a body that's interesting to paint?
It would have to be more than just the body. There would have to be some aura, something else. Something else that can be dealt with rather than just the body, because a body in itself is, it's like one object is... It's what you bring to it, what the association is.
You've done self-portraits also of you in your studio of you shaving, I think?
Yeah.
Is it hard to have to stare at yourself with that kind of, or of your image with that kind of scrutiny?
Well, I didn't, Polaroids were taken of me. Uh-huh. And it wasn't planned, it was just something that happened. And again, it was something I never thought of. It was just kind of a fluke in a way. But in looking at the Polaroids, I saw possibilities for it. The fact that it was an ordinary act, an act of shaving, but also it seemed that it not only was an act, a mundane act of shaving, not only the everyday, but also it had It seemed to represent. It was also an act of self-scrutiny, in a sense, because every time a man shaves, you're looking at yourself day in and day out, year after year. So in time, it becomes something more than just that. And also, it's a certain ritual. Looking at it, it's almost like an actor making up. So there's a sense it can be viewed in those three ways: the ordinary, the artist as an actor. The artist scrutinizing himself. So I guess when I was looking at them, I thought of those things. I don't know if they occurred to me, but just the look of it seemed right, and those drawings resulted from that. Probably one day I'll do a larger painting of one of those drawings.
Of course, as the painter and the model in that, you would have had the opportunity to change features, and you would have the ability to change your face and like what you do when you're looking in the mirror, which,
yeah.
You know, you see is what you get. Would you change it, you know, when
no, because I think I'm after certain things. I'm just trying to get certain things right in the drawing of it. If I distorted myself in a certain way, I think generally people tell me in the self-portraits I tend to make myself a little more a little uglier, a little more grotesque, a little heavier sometimes. Usually they say it's not very accurate. If anything, rather than glorify the way, I probably go the other way. Dress myself down rather than up.
Yeah, I wonder why.
I don't know. in those particular drawings, there's a kind of a grittiness to it. I mean, it's not too precise or clean. I mean, there's a grittiness around the face and other things. I don't know.
Do you relate to people when you're painting them differently than you will to like a landscape?
Can I say that again? Do I relate?
When you're painting a person?
Yeah.
Is it very different than if you're painting a landscape or a room?
Yeah, I tend to get drawn in by particular subjects. I usually don't have a, well, sometimes I have a preconceived idea, but it's vague, and then I'll look for information that will make that idea clearer, and sometimes it works the other way. I might see something and seize on that, so it works both ways.
Mm-hmm. There was a review of the Academy show in
yeah.
the New York Times on Sunday, written by Hilton Kramer. One of his complaints was that the show included work by photorealist painters as well as, you know, more traditional realist painters, and he seemed to be disturbed by the grouping of the two together.
Yeah.
Does that bother you?
It doesn't particularly bother me, because I think the attempt of the show was to be to embrace many things that are going on, and no matter what one thinks of photorealism, it's something that's on the scene, and I think the strength of the show is in its diversity, the fact that many areas were covered.
Is there a division amongst painters between realist painters who paint in different styles?
Yeah, I think so. I think that was probably the same even in the days of abstract expressionists. There were different camps, different ideologies. You know, there's minimal painting, there's decorative painting, there's expressionist painting. There are different camps within a larger category.
What are the big debates, the big issues between the
camps? I think in realism or representational painting, it's the subject matter and the approach to subject matter that different people align themselves with. Say, certain people might be more formalist, maybe because of their earlier backgrounds in painting. At the moment, there are younger painters who are getting involved in a kind of a punk look. At the moment, there's so many things going on. It seems very confusing. It's hard to figure out maybe we're too close to it to really decipher what is actually happening. There's many things going on. And I think that's what's different about this time as, say, when I graduated from art school in 58. It was pretty much, there was a kind of old attitude towards anything that was figurative, like the red barn mentality. And there was abstract expressionism, which was an outgrowth of cubism and the earlier innovations of painting, the first part of the 20th century. I'm rambling. I forgot what the question was.
Was it hard for you to be painting in realistic style when the pioneers of the time weren't?
Well, the first show, the first return to the figure show was at the Modern, and that was and that's been around 20 years. And I was in that show, but what I was doing at that time was more involved in fantasy, and it was more imaginary imagery. I was not working directly from nature, only in drawing. But so my paintings at that time were not what you would call realistic or representational in that sense.
When you were growing up in South Philadelphia, did becoming a painter seem to be a very unattainable goal?
I only lived in South Philadelphia until I was about 5.
Oh.
I grew up in North Philadelphia from then on until I was in art school. But, yeah, it you had to be, in those days, you had to be more defensive about being a painter. Now it seems like everyone is an artist, and there's a much more congenial atmosphere about doing that. But in those days, you hoped that the question would not be asked.
Oh, what was wrong with being a painter? What were you supposed
to
be?
Well, I think maybe it was equivalent to someone saying, a male saying, I'm a dancer. I'm a ballet dancer. I mean, not quite as strongly, but it was, oh, what are you doing that for? Or else it was, you could be the butt of a joke, or what's this guy, one of these starving artists? That type of thing, which is the kind of thing I got from my father would say that.
So
why do you want to paint? Were you going to be a starving artist for the rest of your life?
Your mother was in theater. She might have thought of a different life.
Well, she was in amateur Yiddish theater. It wasn't really on a professional level, but she probably was more sympathetic.
Well, how did you first get recognition? How did you break in?
Well, I was very fortunate. Terry Dittenfass, who handles my work, took some of my prints when I was a senior at PCA, and she had prints, and I was giving her prints and drawings, and a few collectors noticed them. And she was going through a change in her life at the time. And she opened her gallery in New York in 61. There was a group show, and I had the first one-man show there in 61.
A writer who I was recently interviewing who teaches said that in a way he sees it as his job to discourage young writers because the people who aren't very good and don't really have the push to live the kind of difficult life you live when you're getting established as a writer will drop out with some discouragement. And those who have some talent and have the energy that it takes and the will to survive the difficult period are going to do it anyways, no matter how much they're discouraged.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way?
I think that's true. I mean, it's easy to be enthralled, enthusiastic about painting when you're in your 20s, but to sustain it for a lifetime, that's another thing.
So, but, you know, I know teachers want to be really supportive at the same time. Maybe they don't, I don't know. But how do you balance that wish to support people, but also the need to be critical?
Well, I think you have to be supportive. I mean, the benefit of the doubt has to always go with the young painter who's getting started. I lost the thought. What else was it? What was the other part of the question?
Well, the difficulty of balancing the wish to be supportive.
Well, yeah, you have to discuss that. You have to talk realistically about the possibilities of doing that for a lifetime. And I think fortunately, it's much easier today. There seems to be more opportunities. There's more galleries showing the works of recent graduates. There's more media coverage of painters. I mean, just the fact that I'm sitting here now, I mean, maybe that would not have happened 20 years ago. There's more magazines, more small newspapers. The atmosphere right now in art is much more positive about, I hate to use the word, like career in art, but I think there are more possibilities now.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the trade-offs of living in Philadelphia? Is that I know a lot of artists find it.
It's
a lot
easy,
of artists
move
to New York. Let's face it. Yeah.
Well, and I've been asked. I was often asked after I started showing in New York, when are you going to move to the city? Of course, it was the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt it was easier living in Philadelphia. The it's much more relaxed, especially if you're getting started. It's much less expensive getting a studio in Philadelphia than in New York. But I think that one of the trade-offs is that New York still is the center. It's an international city. It's a power center. It's where all the media is, the galleries, writers. So I was fortunate in a way. I was able to get by with my work and still live in Philadelphia. But there are painters here that are doing that now. Maybe 20 years ago it would have been harder. And Philadelphia is much more relaxed. You know, it's accessible. You can sometimes the relaxation gets to you, and that's when you have to go to New York. I mean, sometimes it can be a drag. Sometimes it gets boring, and you need a shot in the arm. I find myself going there once every couple months.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I've been speaking with Sidney Goodman, who's a painter based in Philadelphia. He teaches at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. A couple of his paintings are featured in the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts show on contemporary realism. And he's had one-man shows in a number of places, and one of them that will be opening in December will be at the Virginia Museum in their Institute of Contemporary Art. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
This is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 2:30. In about 5 minutes on Fresh Air, my guest will be novelist E.L. Doctorow. Miles Davis and his recording of In Your Own Sweet Way, and we opened that set with Chet Baker playing Star Eyes. It's 19 minutes to 3 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. With me now on Fresh Air is novelist E.L. Doctorow, whose books integrate history and fiction, fictional characters and historical figures from the recent past live together in his novels. His bestseller Ragtime, first published in 1975, is set at the turn of the century. Architect Stanford White, beauty Evelyn Nesbit, and our anarchist Emma Goldman are some of the real people he uses as characters. In 1971, his novel The Book of Daniel was published, and that was based on the lives of the Rosenbergs. His latest novel, another bestseller, is called Loon Lake, and it's set in the Depression in the Adirondacks, where a roustabout becomes the master of Loon Lake, the huge estate of a robber baron. Doctorow's first book, Welcome to Hard Times, was published in 1960. From 60 to 64, he worked as an editor at New American Library. From 64 to 69, he was an editor-in-chief with Dial. He's in Philadelphia today lecturing in the Temple University Center City Writers Series. By the way, the film Ragtime, directed by Milos Forum, is scheduled to open in Los Angeles in mid-November. And E.L. Doctorow's latest novel, Loon Lake, has just been published in paperback. Welcome to Fresh Air. It's a real treat to have you here.
Thank you.
Since you combine history and fiction in a lot of your work, what's your method of inquiry into the past?
Erratic. It's a very erratic method. In fact, I don't even think it is a method. It's a I'm not aware of having begun any of these books with a clear intention of what I wanted to do or where it would go. And in fact, it had to be pointed out to me that I used historical materials after Ragtime was published. I hadn't realized that before. But really where it begins is in imagery, the images you have in your own head, images that have meaning for you, that have resonance somehow. And it's sort of in pursuit of that feeling you create in yourself with an image or a line or a phrase or even something as unverbal as a sense of rhythm. That you sort of begin a book, and it's some sort of accidental circumstance, really.
A part of your past and your memories as a writer is probably the books you read when you were young. Are there books that you're always drawing on when you're writing about a period, books that were about that period or written in it?
Well, I think writers are The image for a writer, I think of as some sort of recluse sitting in a house with all this garbage around him that he's assiduously and painstakingly collected, old newspapers and photographs and bits and pieces of rag and broken toys and all sorts of stuff that he goes along the street rescuing from garbage pails and not knowing what use he'll make of them. So imagine that sort of kind of house of fiction. And so I think we end up, all of us, knowing a lot more than we think we do. And calling on this stuff when we never expect to.
Do you have, like, family stories about periods that you didn't really live in? Like the Depression, you were really a kid then. I don't know how vivid your memories are from it, but just about every family has its Depression stories that are passed on that keep that period alive.
My family had difficulties in the Depression. My father had a record and musical instrument store down in the old Hippodrome building, on 6th Avenue between 42nd and 43rd Street. And he had hard times, but I was very young then and never, I don't recall deprivation. That wasn't my experience of childhood. I mean, we went to ball games and movies and summer camp. And for all I knew, everything was fine. Of course it wasn't. My recollection of the Depression was kind of street recollection, some of which I put into the Book of Daniel, oddly enough. There seemed to be more mad people on the streets then, perhaps because